Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today. And now, the second half of the examination on how modern Protestantism makes a good case for atheism, with your host, Pastor John Ehlers.
Hello and welcome to the Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers, and I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent. Would like to take this opportunity to invite you to come to one of our services. We meet every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. for divine worship, and we'd love to welcome you. If you don't live in the Orpington area, I invite you to go on to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory to find the Lutheran congregation that's nearest to where you live. Would also like to thank you for your prayerful and financial support, for that is what keeps Lutheran Radio going, and we really appreciate that, and again, thank you very much for all your care and concern. A reminder that the new Lutheran Radio app is now available. You can find it for use on all major platforms, and would encourage you to take advantage of this wonderful opportunity to take Lutheran Radio with you wherever you go. We're back with John McKenzie. We were talking last week about the Protestant understanding of how we experience God in the modern era and also in the postmodern era. We talked about how this may lead and assist modern atheism, as well as how the understanding of the absence of God might actually be a really helpful term in helping us understand who God is and that He actually is present with us. Now, John, in your PhD thesis, you talk about Karl Barth and the influence he had on the Protestant movement. Would you like to expand on his importance and significance to the Protestant movement last century?
As an undergrad at St. Andrew's University, which is a sort of a Barthian hotbed, I spent a lot of time sort of reading Barth and sort of responding to Barth. And I think in many respects, the PhD that I wrote is me getting over Barth. Moving beyond Barth, because the reason why Barth is rightly respected as probably the best Protestant theologian of the 20th century is because what's happening in the unfolding of, as I said before, in the unfolding of philosophical history is that there's a growing skepticism with respect to the possibility of speaking about divine experience. And so someone like Descartes is very happy to talk about God, experience of God, albeit within internalized accounts of how that experience is structured, as we were talking about before. But when you reach someone like Kant, the problem of human experience of the divine becomes I suppose it gets worked into a corner. So Kant wants to say, we can only really have true knowledge of things as we experience them through our senses. And that's the starting point of Kant's transcendental philosophy. He wants to say the only things that we can truly know are the things that we experience through the senses, and beyond that we can't really know anything. And the problem that poses for Christian theology is precisely what we said before. As soon as you say, well, you can only know things that you perceive in a maximal way through an experience of vision or hearing, or touch, then you aren't going to be able to say anything really that tangible about divine experience, because God isn't necessarily present as an object in the world as we expect Him to be. And you can't simply point over there and say, there's God, now we can know what God is like. And so what Kant does is he moves the language of God, or the language of theology, into the realm of ethics. And he wants to say something along the lines of, well, we live in a world where we know that there are right and wrong things, and yet that ethics can't really be motivated by an idea that doing right or wrong is necessarily going to work as an end in itself. If I do bad things, it doesn't necessarily mean bad things will happen to me. If I do good things, it doesn't necessarily mean good things will happen to me. And so he says, well, in order for this to make sense, there must be some kind of account of an afterlife in which right and wrong mean something, in which the right things that I do and the wrong things that I do are judged as such, and the effect is then laid against me. And so what he wants to say is, well, there must be an afterlife, and therefore if there is an afterlife, then there must be a God. And so if you want to talk about God, then you have to talk about it in this sort of sense, through the language of ethics. And you can't really say anything about God other than He must exist in a shadowy kind of way. Now, Karl Barth comes along. He's going to university at sort of the turn of the between the 18th and 19th centuries, 19th and 20th century, sorry. And he's sort of inculcated in this Kantian world where you can't talk about God unless you appeal to ethics or something. And the other option, obviously, that occurs is the account of talking about God as in terms of feeling. And so someone like Friedrich Schleiermacher develops an account of theological language which is based on this feeling of absolute dependence. And neither of these two options Barth finds particularly compelling. Barth wants to say, no, look, if there is a creator God, if there is a God who's created the world, then these sort of deistic arguments don't really seem to match up. Why would God not involve himself more more fundamentally with the world? Why would God not interact with the world that he had created? And so what Barth starts doing is attempting to use Kant in such a way that he can actually go beyond Kant. That's the famous phrase from Bruce McCormack, the most prominent Barthian scholar around at the moment. And what that means is he says, well, look, if we can only know things insofar as they become an object of knowledge, insofar as they become presented to our senses, then let's talk about the theology of the word again. Let's talk about God becoming incarnate as an object of knowledge in order that we can know God. And so Barth's big thing then is almost creating an account of, it actually saves theology in such a way that you can almost adopt an entirely orthodox account of Protestant theology within this modern context formed by Immanuel Kant, and gives Protestantism a possible opening into the sort of 20th century context from which God was rapidly being displaced himself. And so, yeah, Barth is a very important figure precisely because he allows us to talk about God in a world where God has become increasingly hard to speak about. But the problem is, and this is, again, coming back to what I'm doing in the PhD, is saying, well, actually, Barth's account of human experience of the divine is problematic. And it results in this account of divine presence, which has to be aligned with visibility. And so, once again, what you get in Barth's theology is this account of revelation in which God breaks into your consciousness in a really palpable way. And you end up again with this sort of dichotomy that I talked about before between this account of God's existence being confirmed in a very, very visible way on the one hand, but then if you don't have that experience of divine revelation, then God appears to be completely absent. And so you have no way of talking about what I see emerging in Luther's theology, which is this account of hidden presence of the divine, which God comes into the world, presents himself to us in a way that we don't recognize, and it's only through our interaction, our slow interaction with the word within the world, that we come to recognize that is God. For Barth, that's an immediate thing. God cuts through our experiences and we can't doubt his existence. But that leaves you with an uncomfortable decision between a God who is visible in a very palpable way, which a lot of people don't have the experience of, or an account of God being completely absent and therefore essentially non-existent. And so that I argue in the PhD that Barth's earlier theology in particular hastens again the rise of modern atheism. Now I do later on in the PhD argue that Barth develops his theology in a way that actually is far closer to what Luther is doing, but I think I've said enough about Barth for the time being.
Well, you said part of the reason for writing this is sort of exercising Barth from you, but or replacing him. But what have you replaced him with? Is it Luther? You know, Luther wrote in the 1520s, 1530s, 1540s. How can that be relevant today?
Well, to reiterate what I've been saying, for what I find in Luther's theology is an account of divine presence that also includes this account of absence as well. And I think part of the problem that we get in modernity and postmodernity is that everything has been conceived of in terms of this dichotomy between a visible presence or an invisible absence. So if you can't see God, then he can't exist. But if you do see God, then he's visible, and therefore you can't doubt that he exists. And so you move between these two points. Whereas what I think you find in at least Luther's Heidelberg Disputation is an account of a sort of mixture of those two, a sort of a via media between the two of them, where you have a presence, but also an absence in terms of the invisibility of God as well, the fact that God appears under his opposite in a way that we don't immediately recognize it. Now, of course, what I argue in the PhD is that actually Luther's a little bit more complicated than that. There is in Luther's theology a bit of a contradiction insofar as he does adopt this second way of talking about divine invisibility as well. And that comes through in De Servo Arbitrio on the bondage of the will. And what Luther does there when he's responding to Erasmus is develop an account of God's hiddenness, which looks a lot more like the hiddenness that I'm talking about emerging within modernity, where God is absolutely hidden. And this comes out of Luther's language, Luther's attempt to defend a sort of almost deterministic account of God and predestination. And Luther, I argue, in the PhD, kind of argues himself into a circle. But a lot of the scholarship has recognized this, that Luther has sort of two different aspects, and the failure of his theology in De Servo Arbitrio is precisely that he forgets the fact that God reveals himself to us in the Word. What you end up with in De Servo Arbitrio is this account that there's almost two words. There's the Word that God reveals, in which God reveals himself as the Word incarnate. But there's also this hidden God who is behind that Word, and we can never really know who that is. But the strength of Luther's early theology is precisely saying, you know, the Word who comes to us in the world, is that God. You can look at the Word as it appears to us, and we can know that that is what God is like. I'm arguing that Luther is a little bit more complicated there, but a lot of the problems with Luther's scholarship arise out of that distinction. And what I argue is, given that modern philosophy became the way that we expressed Protestant theology, a lot of Lutheran scholars operating within the 19th, 20th centuries, and even into the 21st, adopt this sort of Kantian account of human experience, which results in this problematic account of a divine hiddenness. And so what I suggest is that actually this other aspect of Luther's theology, this account of hidden presence, kind of gets brushed under the carpet a little bit, because there's no way in which to express it. And so part of my PhD, it sort of concludes, that the final chapter concludes sort of arguing that, you know, there's another aspect to Luther's theology that a lot of the mainstream theologians have missed. This account, as I said, of hidden presence, account that God comes to us in the world and actually reveals himself to us in a slow, sort of more negative way, that he kind of works against our ideas, and revelation isn't something that's just something like a flash of light, but actually it's a slow process, it's a hard process, it's a difficult process. And we slowly, through that process, learn we develop this sort of shadowy account of what God is like, and it grows and grows and grows. But again, you never really arrive at that point where you fully know God. You're always sort of on the way towards engaging with Him in the world, and through that, knowing Him.
So as you're reading Luther, how does the self and the revealed Word and the hiddenness of God and the proclamation of the Word, whether that's preaching or in the sacraments, how do those all fit together then? How do they fit together in our experience?
Well, again, for me, the real strength of the Lutheran denomination is its account of the sacraments, because I think everything that I'm saying at a sort of, as you say, at a very highfalutin conceptual level is contained within the Lutheran theology of the sacrament. And what you get in the sacrament is everyone coming together, the church coming together around the elements in which God is present, and reminding themselves that God is so great that he can make himself present even under these seemingly arbitrary aspects of the created world and the bread and wine. And as a result of that, then, in participating in the Eucharist, we are made more into the likeness of God. But that never occurs in a completely visible way, as I've been saying. It's never the case that we've arrived when we do Lutheran theology. There's always this realization that we then have to go out into the world, and we have to live as witnesses to that divine presence, live as witnesses to Christ in the world. And so what you start getting is this sort of cyclical, it's a very cyclical account of the human experience of God. We join together in the church, we experience divine presence, we're made into the likeness of God, and then we go out into the world and we present that presence as living sacrifices, as it's put. And so, what you sort of get is a sort of, as I'm saying, it's a sort of circularity there. God reveals himself through our engagement within the sacrament, through our reading of the word, through the preaching, and we're made through that experience into people who are more like God, and then we go out into the world and we live as children of God. And but that's never completed. We always have to return back to the sacrament. So the weekly sort of calendar for the Lutheran kind of goes: go out into the world, come back to the sacrament. Go out into the world, come back into the sacrament. And we'll never arrive, I don't think, at that. Obviously, at that the point that we want to arrive at in this life. But that doesn't mean to say that we aren't still living in every moment in this sort of trajectory towards God. And so I think you get revelation in a sort of hidden way, but as a result of that, we are slowly made into children of Christ, and then we go out into the world and we continue that process. So it's always a process; it's always in via, and we'd never sort of think that we've arrived at the end point.
So it sounds to me like you've been able to take your academic studies, which sound, as you mentioned, quite cerebral, but apply them to your daily life, apply them to the worship life of the church, apply them to your devotional life. Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. And I think as I said before, I grew up in a Baptist background, and actually sort of arriving at the Lutheran Church was, again, part of a process that has taken 10 years over the course of my academic career, and what I found in the Lutheran Church is a context of worship that fits with my ideas of what the Christian life should be, and I suppose that only could have happened if I'd gone through the sort of more cerebral intellectual studies that I did. And so for me, there always has to be that balance between the two. We always have to know what it is that we believe. We always have to be ready to be able to give an account of what it is that we believe, as it says in Peter. And I think that it's that sort of interaction between the way that we think and the way that we act that we really miss out on sometimes. We sometimes think, you know, well, church is when we kind of go and think about God, and then we just go out into the world, and there's a sort of distinction between the two. But for me, precisely because of my experience of the sacraments and my engagement with God in the church service, I'm then able to go out into the world and then live. So, and this is the message of justification by faith, as I read it. It's this idea that, you know, we are able to live because we've been made into something. We don't have to make ourselves into something in order to live. And so the Lutheran Church, for me, offers a very compelling account of how, actually the way that we talk about divine experience, the way that we talk about God, can actually influence your life.
And again, it strikes me as very interesting, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but from my understanding of most Baptists, the sacrament of the Lord's Supper is, you know, it's important, but it's not held as something up, you know, nearly as high as it is in Lutheranism. And to hear you speak about how important that is for you now that you are a Lutheran, how did you come to that realization, or how did you come to that, as I say, it sounds like a real transformation within your life?
Yeah, and I suppose, I mean, the Baptist position is essentially Zwinglian. So there's this idea that what happens in the Lord's Supper is commemoration. I always like to say there's a sort of very ironic sort of attitude towards the Lord's Supper in Baptist churches that I've grown up in that, you know, you can't really talk about there being any real presence. You can't talk about there being any effect of the sacrament upon you. When you take the sacrament, nothing changes about you. Nothing changes about the sacrament. But they're always very ready to say people shouldn't be taking the sacrament. So anyone who's taking it wrongly, it does bad things. So they sort of have an account of real presence if you're taking it in the wrong way, but none other beside that. And I suppose my frustration with that has grown out of the fact that, you know, I think as Bart is saying, you know, unless God is present within the world, then that's not a theological system that I can live comfortably with. And here in Cambridge, almost everyone adopts a very sort of positive, robust, almost platonic account of divine presence within the world, which I find equally problematic. But I sort of find myself between these two, that unless God is actually really present within the world, then there's no way we could possibly know who he is. And I think a lot of that comes from my realization that human experience is embodied. All of our experiences are developed in the face of the world, and as such, unless God makes himself a part of that world or comes into that world in some way, then we could never arrive at an understanding of what God is. And so, yeah, my movement towards the Lutheran Church is sort of born on the back of that frustration with the account of non-presence that you get in the Baptist traditions, particularly in the account of the sacraments, but then the overly positive account of presence that you get in the sort of higher Anglican and Roman Catholic churches. So I kind of find myself between the two.
And it also, again, excuse me if I'm wrong, and please correct me, but it sounds like Luther's teaching on simultaneously saint and sinner is important to you as well. You talked about how we never are reaching what we want to be or what God wants us to be, but, you know, we're still struggling with that sin. But is that important for you as well in your understanding and in your own life?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the way that I would express that is precisely the fact that, you know, we don't, in life, there's always a sort of gap between where we are and where we should be. That's just the case in all areas. And now, given the fact that we are saved through faith, and that isn't called into question, that doesn't mean to say that as we actually live it out, it appears that way to us. And so the Christian finds themselves caught in this sort of movement between creation and eventual salvation that is never easy. There will be doubts that arise. There is movement forwards and backwards. We veer one way then the other. But whilst our salvation is unquestioned, because our salvation is in the hands of God, and therefore out of our hands, as it were, it doesn't mean to say that in our lives towards God, as we move to the terminus ad quem of our existence, that it presents as something easy. It's always difficult. There's always hiddenness, as well as presence, and we find ourselves in that kind of confusing situation all the time.
So, can I put you on the spot then? Can you give me your summary or your idea of what you think the future of Protestant theology or the Protestant church is, and perhaps even what you see the future of the Lutheran church being?
Sure. Well, firstly, as I said, you know, I think Protestant theology really has to come to grips with whatever it is we mean by post-modernity. And I think in particular that's going to have to involve some kind of realization that, you know, the modern project isn't necessarily all it's cooked up to be. And we have to raise the question ourselves to what extent we've been influenced by this modern project, where we've sort of developed accounts of human experience, of human knowing, where things can be cut and dried. You can say, there is a God, we know it, I've experienced it, and that, therefore it's completely indubitable to me. And I think a lot of what happens in the churches that I've come from, and I'm sure it happens in Lutheran churches as well, is that the language of doubt has fallen out of parlance altogether. No one wants to talk about having doubts, because they feel as though if they talk about that, then it calls into question their salvation. And in the Protestant church in particular, in the Baptist church in particular, that has resulted from this sort of internalization of the human experience of the divine. Now, human experience of the divine is something that happens in your mind, and therefore belief is sort of couched in terms of making sure that you think the right things. And so as soon as you start saying, well, I have a doubt about how this appears, or I have a doubt about whether, and sometimes I doubt whether or not God exists even. Like, you can't do that in the Baptist church. And I think we have to come to terms with the fact that that's just an unbiblical position. You know, however you read the Bible, you know, you read in the Psalms, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? And this sort of wandering in the wilderness with the children of Israel, where they're constantly crying out to God, where are you? Why are you not the God that we want? And I think that the Protestant church really has to come to terms with that. It has to recognize that things like doubt and dubitability do not therefore result in calling into question everything. And again, it comes back to that dichotomy that I talked about that emerges in the modern, postmodern era, where everything is either completely 100% certain, visible presence, or everything's completely 100% doubted and therefore absent. And we've got to learn that actually, you know, there's, it's a spectrum. You can be in between those two. We can have certainty that isn't the sort of certainty that the modernity wants, where we can't possibly doubt it. I find that idea very much a reflection of the biblical language, where you have a certainty that God will save you, but that doesn't necessarily manifest itself to the detriment of having doubts about it every once in a while. So I think that's primarily where Protestantism has to go. And the reason I think that is because as soon as you start, what happens when you just adopt the negative critiques of reading of postmodernity is that you start building what Manuel Castells has called fortress mentalities, where people pretend that everyone ignoring the church is simply the result of sin or something like that. And so they'll say, well, you know, everyone would call into question Christianity completely because that's Satan working or something, and that's simply a really bad excuse for being, I think, lazy and not really thinking about what it is that we're presenting. So I think what's happening more and more in Protestantism is these resistance communities are forming, where you get smaller and smaller churches, and they think they're 4 or 5 people in the congregation, and they think they're going to be the only ones in heaven because everyone else has fallen away. And so what I think is, as soon as you start adopting a sort of more positive attitude towards postmodernity, there becomes a recognition that actually there is hope for the future. There is, the Protestant tradition does have things to say to people who are reading even Derrida, right? Even Gilles Deleuze and Guattari. We don't simply have to say, well, you know, they're so negative that they've thrown the baby out of the bathwater. We can say, yeah, sure, these are your concerns to the people who are reading postmodern philosophy. But look, the Protestant tradition has this healthy account of absence as well. We don't think that everything is certain and sorted out, and we have an account of metaphysics which is actually quite compelling to a lot of people in the present day, I think. So that's where Protestantism has to go. As for Lutheran theology, again, I think we need to move beyond reading Luther simply through Kant. And I think that's what has happened and will go on to happen. But there are positive signs. The Finnish Lutheran School is doing nominally good things. I think a lot of what they do is simply hermeneutically suspect. They try and make Luther into something that he isn't. But in doing that, they do recognize that the sort of standard readings of Luther are questionable. You can't simply read Luther as a sort of modern, proto-modern thinker. He does have those aspects in his thinking, but he's also a medieval thinker, and we've sort of forgotten what that means as well. So, the Finnish School of Lutheran Studies are reminding us what medieval Luther might look like. And so there are positive things happening, and I think there is happening in the world as well, a sort of move beyond liberalism. We're becoming more and more post-liberal, which means that there is a positive attitude towards the concept of religion now. In the sort of 70s and 80s, we sort of fell into this sort of anarchic post-modernity, post-structuralism, where we couldn't know anything. And now I think people are realizing, you know, life is uncertain. We can't, if you're going to be uncertain about things, you can't be certain that you can't know anything as well. So I think it's a really positive period in Christian theology. I'm excited to be working there now, particularly in Lutheran theology, because I think, again, Luther is becoming, outside of the Lutheran theological circles, accepted as being a very interesting thinker, precisely because he offers these sort of more postmodern, ideas that are more kind of germane to postmodern concerns. So I think it's a very exciting period for both Protestant theology and Lutheran theology.
Now, many of our listeners will probably come across folks, friends, neighbors, family members even, who will say to them all of these arguments that the modernists have used or postmodernists use against Christianity. How can they respond to those, I suppose, in a loving, coherent Christian way? Any advice to them?
Well, one of the things that I like to say to my friend Boris Gunievich is that when you're a Lutheran or you're a Lutheran theologian, you have a head start on all other theologians, all other denominations, because Luther is very much, you can't read Luther without being aware of his flaws. And I think one of the most important things as a theologian, as a Christian living in the world, is to recognize that, you know, that we always have our flaws, and they never appear to us like that at the time, but they're always there. And I think, for me, reading Luther, and Luther's readings of scripture, particularly, You're always filled with this sense, you know, you say so many good things, Luther, but you say so many terrible things as well. And I think that, for me, that gives me a realization that, you know, you almost have to approach the theological task, as Luther says, by sinning boldly. You have to go out there and you can present ideas. You don't need to be worried about being right or wrong. Well, at least being wrong, I guess, is you should be obviously attempting to be right, but the point is that you don't need to go out there being so terrified of saying anything in case it is wrong. And I think that's a sort of attitude which will come across as in a very positive way in the contemporary climate, where you go out and say, look, yeah, I have these problems too. I don't think I have all the right answers, and a lot of the time I'm struggling with my own ideas. But as I read scripture, as I read, as I go around in the world, I see this, and yeah, maybe I'm wrong, etc. And I think that's a very positive way of presenting what the Lutheran faith presents. This idea that we are in via, that we are living a life before God, of course, but that doesn't necessarily preclude us from doing a Peter and failing in catastrophic ways. And I think people's problem, at least as I see it in universities today, the problem that people have, living as I do within the university and within a university context, is that they see Christianity as almost preaching to people, telling people what the right answer is. And expressing these ideas in a sort of non-negotiable way. And I think one of the, whilst I suppose Luther is in many respects non-negotiable in his own approach, I think that as Lutheran thinkers, we can read Luther and recognize that, you know, there are contradictions in what he says. He doesn't always get it right, but he's not scared to just go out there and say what he thinks and to work through issues in the face of them as well. I think that's what we need to do as Lutherans in the present day. Go out there and get alongside people and work through, converse with them and have interesting conversations and not think that what they're going to say is going to call into question what we think, but also think, well, what we're going to say is going to call into question what they think. And I think we have a lot of very good things to say in the contemporary climate.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your time and your really interesting insights into what's going on in the Protestant world today. And we wish you every blessing as you prepare for your Vifa. And hopefully we'll be able to have a look at this when it gets published as well. So.
Yeah. No, thank you very much. It's been really enjoyable to chat to you.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.